Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello and welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket. The big debate this week isn't will England beat South Africa in the Test Series, which is beautifully poised at 1-1, or will they eventually regain the Ashes in Australia, or will India dominate world cricket forever, as they seem to be doing at the moment. No, the big debate this week is who is the better all-rounder out of Ben Stokes, Ian Botham and Andrew Flintoff. So, what's your view, Simon? And by the way, we'll preview the test match afterwards, but this is the most important matter of the week.
Well, you put me right on the spot there. Three fantastic cricketers, hard to separate any of them. No, we won't sit on the fence, will we?
No, we won't sit on the fence, actually. We're going to give you our very carefully considered and researched views on this. Your overall hunch, let's say.
Botham, Stokes, Flintoff.
Right, OK. Yeah, I'd go with that as well, actually. Not much disagreement, but we will disagree on the finer detail because, I mean, firstly, I just have to say, I mean, Botham's bowling was outstanding. Even, you know, people said he declined massively, and of course he did, but even when I played with him at Durham for a couple of years, and even though he was bowling at about 54 miles an hour, he actually still had something.
He was slower than you.
It was even slower than me. It was a relief having him at the other end, actually, because there was someone who was slower than me. But he had the keeper standing up to the stumps a lot of the time. But he had that ability to just get the ball to do something, hit the bat a bit harder than it looked as if he would, because he had that incredible strength, you know, upper body strength. And the ball arrived with passion and determination and almost I want to humiliate a batsman sort of emotion to it as well. I don't know if you can bowl the ball with emotion, but
I think you can.
Maybe you can. And so, you know, that was his heavy ball. And I remember the time he got Viv Richards out, you know, that was their last season, and Viv was playing for Glamorgan, and he came in a Benson Hedges game, early season game, and we put both of them on straight away. And he was terrified of getting out, and so he was scared to play a shot off him. And Beefy absolutely loved it. He revelled in, you know, a final go against his greatest friend. And foe, and he bowled this sort of lollopy medium pacer with the keeper stood up. Viv tried to turn it for a careful single, and the caution undid him because he got a leading edge, caught and bowled. And both of them hit the ground one-handed and caught the ball, sort of stretched out, landing in mid-pitch. And, you know, there was this sort of Richter scale shaking of the ground as this huge figure crashed to the ground and got this catch. But he got the ball and he clenched it to his fist and he punched the air, and it was almost like the best wicket he'd ever taken. It's almost like he won the Ashes on his own.
Because you played with him, didn't you, at the end of your career? What was that like? What was that experience like?
Well, it was obviously very tiring and quite expensive because he'd drink all the most expensive wine and then split the bill. But
No one stood up to him. No one said, hold on, Beefy, you've just bought this wine, cost X.
Because he'd say, how many bloody test wickets did you take? And, you know, you had to split the bill. So there was no kind of argument there. But it was always fun. And, I mean, my abiding memory is just this will to win. And that's why I would put him ahead of Stokes and Flintoff, because, not saying that either of those didn't have the will to win, but that Botham's will to win was just overcame everything, and it transmitted itself into the team. So there were games we played where we didn't really deserve to win the match, but he sort of said, right, you know, we can win this game, boys. And in fact, the first ever game I played with him for Durham against Lancashire, it was Durham's first game as a first-class county. It was a one-day game. And he effected a run-out of 7 to win for Lancashire. He effected a brilliant run-out from mid-wicket, hit the stumps, side-on, won the game. Mm-hmm. So it was things like that. Even though he was totally ruined physically by then, he could still do it. And you know, that to me was why, plus his incredible bowling for that spell for sort of 5 years, 78 to 82, 83, you know, where he swung the ball late both ways, bowled at probably high 80s miles an hour, you couldn't get the ball off him. You know, you think of that test match in India, where he scored 100 and took 12 wickets in absolutely intense heat. And he was up half the night drinking with Chris Lander of the Daily Mirror as well. So, you know, incredible energy and zest for life, which enabled him to have that impact on the game.
You've been canvassing the opinions of your cricketer colleagues as well. So is it worth hearing from them first of all?
Yeah, sure it is. So this is first Hugh Turbeville, who's been watching the game since the 1980s and was a big sort of Botham fan in that era and has been writing on the game since the 90s. So he's well-versed in all three people's careers. Then two younger journalists, James Coyne and the cricketer digital editor Sam Morshead. Hugh Turbeville first.
Ben Stokes and Ian Botham are the best batsmen. OK, they're both capable of scoring belligerently, but they've also got very good techniques and very good in defence. Both and brilliant sort of 1981 at Headingley. We all know what he did there. Brisbane 86-7. He could smack it everywhere, couldn't he? But he also had the defensive technique, as he showed at the Oval against Pakistan in 1987, where he scored 50 off 200 odd balls to sort of block as well. He had everything. And Stokes is similar, isn't he? He's shown that he can smash it everywhere, but as he showed at Headingley last summer, he scored 2 runs in his first 50 balls against Australia. So I would say they're the two best batsmen. I'd say Flintoff isn't quite in their league. He'll be insulted by that, won't he? He's a very good batsman, of course, but I don't think he's quite there. Bowling, I think Ian Botham, between the age of 19 and 23, was absolutely fantastic. Geoffrey Boycott doesn't talk too often about Botham, doesn't he, how fabulous he was, but he does say he was a brilliant bowler. He swung it and at pace. So I think Stokes, bowling handy. Flintoff, brilliant bowler, 2 left-handers. I've got to go for Botham there overall. I think he was the ultimate cricketer. People say Stokes could be as good as Botham, but he is only sort of halfway, 5/8 way through his career. So maybe judge him at the end. Maybe say Stokes was as good as Botham, but I think he's not as good as Botham at the moment.
I think with the potential to still improve Stokes, I would say, on the basis that he still has time to grow, I think we're probably slightly biased in that we're seeing him now at his peak. So he has the potential to go any of the ways, I suppose. I think if you're talking about technique, batting technique, Stokes has got the best technique of the lot. He's played more key innings now, I think, than even Botham did. And Botham played some great innings, you know, at Brisbane.
14 Test hundreds.
14 Test hundreds. Who, Botham? Yeah, I mean, how many Stokes got? 8. Okay, maybe not then. But I think he's certainly shown he's got the best technique of them. Both of them in the first half of his career was obviously an extraordinary all rounder, probably the best of the three. But his career, we did see how his career did taper off for various reasons. So we hope that Stokes, in this possibly slightly more professional game than it was then, won't do that. You know, he should keep his body in tip-top shape, and hopefully if he's still able to bowl, that's the big question, because, you know, a few weeks ago I was thinking that maybe Stokes would, you know, his bowling was going to get rationed and he may even give it up and he might become England captain, but we've seen that he has the potential to really have these amazing impact spells like he did at Cape Town.
Well, out of the three, unfortunately I didn't get to see Botham much in his prime, particularly live. I've seen the highlights and the great footage of his heroics at various points, but from a personal perspective it's been Flintoff versus Stokes, and for me, Flintoff still edges it currently, simply from the bowling perspective. I think that he added a huge amount more than Stokes does with the ball now. Obviously, with a batting perspective, Stokes offers a great deal more than Flintoff probably ever did. But I still think there's more to come, obviously, from Stokes, whereas Flintoff's career is over. So in time, I'm sure that it will go the other way. But at the moment, it's Freddie for me.
We haven't really heard your, you know, detailed assessment here, Simon. Some stats to back up some arguments.
Well, what I look at when you talk about all-rounders, you look at a batting average that's above a bowling average. So if you're a class all-rounder, you want your batting average to be above your bowling average. Ian Botham, plus 5.14 in Test cricket. In other words, his batting average was 33.54 and his bowling average was 28.40, so plus 5.14. Stokes at the moment is plus 3.24. In other words, his batting average is 36.16, his bowling average is 32.92. Flintoff is minus 2.01, and that means his bowling average is above his batting average for his 79 test matches. So if you just look at those pure stats, you can rate Botham, Stokes, Flintoff in that order. What that doesn't tell you, of course, is that are the individual performances in certain series, in certain matches. I mean, they were both three fabulous cricketers. That's the other thing. I mean, you look at Australia, you know, they haven't really produced a decent all-rounder for many, many decades. Sort of crying out for one. England have produced three. And I'd say three... in my lifetime of watching, there's also Tony Gregg, who was a, you know, very good all-rounder in the 1970s, much more of a batting all-rounder than, you know, a sort of bowling all-rounder as well.
You've forgotten David Capel and Mark Eno.
Well, I know. I'm so sorry about that. And yourself, you occasionally got a few runs, didn't you? Anyway, so, yeah, so Tony Gregg as well, although, you know, you could say he was, you know, I know he had Scottish ancestors and he was really South African, but you know he was also a fine all-rounder for England in the 1970s, a fine cricketer. Don't underestimate him. But you know, you think of those sort of three players that we all experience in terms of, well, you played with Ian Botham, and you know you've watched all of them, and I've watched all of them as well. England fantastically fortunate to have them. Really, I mean, it's amazing they've been able to produce three fantastic cricketers.
Yeah, I mean, on the stats there, you know, good stats, well researched. Both of them, 14 test hundreds. That's the thing I think is incredible. And in a way, he would have made more hundreds if he hadn't bowled so many overs. Because he bowled so many overs and had such an impact as a bowler, he didn't have the mental energy to bat long
periods.
But
isn't that the challenge? Isn't that the challenge of being a great all-rounder?
Yes,
though?
It is. It is a massive challenge.
That's what makes you a great all-rounder. If you're able to bowl all those overs, take all those wickets, and then come out and score those runs as well. For example, look at someone like Jack Callis. 166 test matches, averaged 55.37, and still had time to take 292 test wickets as well. I mean, absolutely phenomenal. We talked about both of being plus 5.14 and Stokes plus 3.24. Callis plus 22.72. And then there's one player, of course, who's even better than that, and that's Gary Sobers, averaged 57.78 and took his wickets at 34.03, so plus 23.75. So, you know, there is that challenge, isn't there? You say about that, you know, you bowl all these overs, then you've got to go out and bat. But Callis and Sobers were able to do it as well.
Yeah, and I mean, they both kept themselves very fit. Mm. I mean, Callis, I suppose at times, did his weight went up a bit, but he still bowled a fair number of overs. And Sobers was incredibly fit throughout his career, despite the fact that he sort of drank, I think, rum or brandy sort of during the day, and famously went off during a test match innings and needed brandy before he could come back on again. So remarkable fitness and productivity from both of those players. That's where I think Stokes, in the end, might score not perhaps quite as highly as Callis, but he'll be getting up there because his fitness, we all know, is very, very important to him. He's very, very dedicated to his fitness. And that'll enable him, A, to get a higher batting average, ultimately. I mean, his batting now, I think his batting is better than Botham's now because it's not as necessarily destructive, although it can be, but he's got that resolution, he's got the technique. Botham's technique was good, But he could be fallible to a good ball initially. He was sometimes didn't move his feet very much. And, you know, he liked to try and go at the ball just short of a length outside off stump and try and attack it. So, you know, he would get out occasionally. And it's understandable because his role was to be aggressive. But Stokes can bat at number four. I don't think Beefy would ever have been able to bat really at number four.
He could bat at five.
He could bat at five or six. Stokes can bat at four. He can bat at three. Because he's got that technical and mental dedication to the crease to be able to play long innings. So I think in the end, his batting average of, what is it, 36 now, is disappointing for a guy of that talent. And that's going to go up. I think it will get to 40 or maybe more. And he's got 8 test hundreds now. I think he'll get to more than Botham's 14. So that differential between batting and bowling averages is going to get perhaps to sort of 7 or 8 in the end, whereas Botham's is 5. So, you know, it's going to... It might just, you know, to the end of his career... And the other thing is, he'll probably be able to sustain his career, whereas Beefy sort of went into decline.
Yeah. I mean, we're not quite comparing like for like. We're talking about all-rounders, aren't we? And three quality all-rounders. But, you know, Ian Botham was an opening bowler. You know, he took the new ball, and he was a number six batsman for England. Stokes has batted at number six for England.
But I think his first test 100 in Perth was number 7. Yeah, actually.
But they, you know, they pushed him up the order. Now he's number 5, and he doesn't open the bowling. He's very much the fourth bowler as well. And you could see a case where, you know, his bowling role diminishes as his batting role takes over. It just depends who is there to do the other jobs. But I mean, England in recent test matches have played 5 seamers, and Stokes has been very much the fifth seamer. I mean, he's certainly got it within him to be that fourth bowler. It is just a question of fitness of a different sort. We're not talking about, I mean, Ian Botham's fitness, because he lived life to the full off the field, it probably did decline in the second half of his career quite markedly. Whereas Stokes is a different issue, isn't it? It's more the wear and tear on his knees. So there's a different issue there. Of course, Andrew Flintoff had those issues as well with his fitness, which undermined his longevity, really, as an England cricketer. I mean, there was a time when Flintoff, I think, would have rivaled Botham as a threat with the ball, wouldn't you? I mean, there were times when he was fast and nasty.
Yeah, I mean, I think overall that Flintoff had great moments or great series, whereas Botham was a truly great cricketer.
Yeah.
And I think Stokes will be, if he isn't already. And the other thing we haven't mentioned, of course, about all-round cricket is fielding, and all of them excellent in the slip, Corden. Yeah. Both of them taking some great catches many of which we've seen. Flintoff too, very solid at slip. No one had the agility of Stokes, who could run very fast at a ball on the boundary and hurl it in like he does and take those ridiculous catches like the one at the Oval against South Africa. So I'd give Stokes an extra mark for his versatility in the field.
Yeah, because Botham was a brilliant slip fielder, but generally fielded in the slips, didn't he? And
Stokes... I mean, he was a good outfielder as well, but he wasn't as mobile or as fast as Stokes is.
Because one thing we're overlooking here, we're talking about test match all-rounders. What we haven't looked at is their white ball careers as well. Who was more effective as a white ball cricketer? Ian Botham played 116 one-day internationals. He only had a top score of 79. Flintoff played 141 one-day internationals, made 300s and 1850s. Stokes has played 95 one-day internationals, 300s, 2050s, but only 70 wickets. His one-day form, I would say, sort of puts him ahead of the other two. I mean, Ian Botham actually was... You'd think he was the archetypal one-day cricketer, wouldn't you? Just he would be your first name on the team sheet. But actually, his batting record was quite disappointing. But he did take wickets, and he did also... His economy rate is under 4. But in a different era, because batsmen didn't score as quickly in the era in which he played, or didn't try to score as quickly in the era in which he played.
Yeah, true. I would say, if I had to choose one of those players for a one-day international, I might choose Flintoff. Mm. Partly because his bowling was so reliable. You could get the 10 overs out of him and he would bowl very good pace, consistent back of the length, horrible awkward lift, and he could bowl a great Yorker as well. So, and plus, you know, you come into bat at number 7 and smash a quick 50. Mm. So I think actually from a one-day point of view, I might almost give it to Flintoff with Stokes as a sort of second. But and Botham obviously playing in a different era, he would have probably adjusted to the modern era and been more attacking with the bat and maybe had some more tricks with the ball. But Flintoff, for me, actually as a one-day cricketer, was supreme.
Yeah, 169 wickets. I mean, the interesting thing about this debate and Ian Botham is the sort of unknown of modern-day fitness, whether he would have sort of complied with the modern-day regimes and sort of gone along with it. Because
well, I think he would have had to have.
Yeah.
Because he would have had no choice. Really.
And if he had have done, then I think you know he would have been so much more effective for so much longer. I think that was the thing. I mean, you see him towards the end of his career. You mentioned it when you were playing in the Durham. Even for England, he was sort of trundling in towards the end. He was a sort of pale imitation of himself, you know. But you know, when he was bowling in the late 70s, I mean, he was quick and he swung it, and he was a devastating bowler.
Totally. I mean, I tried to copy him and obviously failed, but I loved the way he swung the ball both ways, and I copied that, and I also copied his slower ball, which was an off break, and I had great delight. One of the highlights of my career actually is once bowling at him at Lords for Middlesex. And in a one-day game, and I bowled him my slower ball, and he thought it was my quicker one, went for the big drive, lobbed it straight up in the air, caught, and he walked off, stomped off back to the pavilion at Lords, and he walked past John Embry on the way off, and he said, there, that's how to bowl an off break.
How many times did you get him out?
Oh, I don't remember. But,
come on, you must remember.
No, I honestly don't. I mean, three or four times.
Right, okay.
But that was my favourite because it was a genuine piece of deception, and it was copied from the ball I saw him bowl in the 1970s. You say about his fitness, and of course, that was legendary. His sort of after hours activities, and actually in this next issue of the Cricketer magazine, we've got a feature with Peter Hayter, the former Mail on Sunday cricket correspondent, known as Reggie in the business. Because his father was Reg Hayter, who founded the Hayter Sports Agency. And he tells the story of ghosting Botham's autobiography and basically went on various trips to the West Indies and a fishing trip somewhere or other and various sort of weeks spent in his company, all of it drinking, and very little memory of anything that he'd achieved, actually. He sort of almost erased it and didn't think it was important, always wanted to look ahead rather than back. So his autobiography wasn't a greatest literary work, but he wasn't someone who liked to reflect on the past anyway.
Yeah. I mean, all three of them have had their off-field scrapes as well. Does it come with the territory?
I suppose so. It's just that warrior-like attitude on the field is not easy to switch off when you're off the field. And it obviously started with Beefy and Ian Chappell in the 1970s when he was in Melbourne on a scholarship and encountered Chappell being rude about England and the Poms, and they came to blows, and they've hated each other ever since. And that was the sort of first of a few sequence of incidents in Botham's life. And as you say, the others have dabbled with various controversies as well. I think it's that you can't expect someone to be a lion on the field and a pussycat off it.
OK, well, let's round up our sort of assessment of them as cricketers. I think Botham, Stokes, Flintoff in that order. In terms of bowling, I would say Botham, Flintoff, Stokes. And in terms of batting, I would say Botham and Stokes are roughly the same. Stokes better technique and has got the potential to go past Botham in the rest of his career, but he's got to get another 600s to go level with him. Probably he's got plenty of time to do that as well. You'd back him to do that. In fact, you'd be quite disappointed if he doesn't. So it may well be that Stokes would end up as the better batsman of the two, and then Flintoff in third place. So Flintoff's second in the bowling and third in the batting. Both of them definitely right up there in the bowling, number one, and sort of vying with Stokes possibly, you know, as time goes on, and possibly already actually nudging ahead as a batsman.
And if you had to choose one, well, I would choose both of them because of his brilliance with the ball, that natural skill of being able to take wickets on a flat pitch in unsuitable surroundings, making the ball swing, making the ball do something to get good players out. That, I think, is invaluable.
Yeah. Ian Botham, the first half of his career, definitely the best of the three, I would say. Without a doubt. No doubt about it.
Right, let's talk about the world of cricket generally now for a few minutes. And I'd just like to refer to Andrew Sampson's column in the next issue of The Cricketer, talking about Stokes and his achievements in that Cape Town Test match. He says if he got to 100 in that second innings, when he made 72 or 40-odd balls, he would have been only the second person to make 200s before lunch in a test match, or two amounts of 100 before lunch, because, of course, he did it in Cape Town the time before when he made 258. The other person to have done that is a left-hander also.
Oh, well, I've just got all the left-handers from history to think over.
Brian Charles Lara
All right.
Was the other one who's done that. And also, he's the first English fielder to take five catches in innings as well. I mean, that's probably well-known now, but that's a hell of an achievement.
It was funny at the post-match presentation where Stokes was trying to push Dominic Sibley forward to take the other. He's the man of the match. We mentioned this last week, but I mean, an all-round performance from Stokes. It was hard to resist, really. Wickets, crucial wickets, runs, catches. I know Sibley's innings did set up England's victory. Actually, Sibley's the only century maker so far in the series. You've got quite long odds on that after two test matches at the start of the series.
And I can see him repeating it at Port Elizabeth as well, because it's a flat pitch, that. Yeah. It might suit him pretty well. So if he can get through that early period with the new ball, he could easily score another 100. What I think England will need in Port Elizabeth more than they needed in Cape Town is pace, for the simple reason the pitch is really slow there. I've still got this image in my head of Dale Steyn at Port Elizabeth, clean bowling Michael Vaughan with the most fantastic late outswinger, which was ripped out his off stump. And Steyn was absolutely irresistible at Port Elizabeth. You need someone with that extra zest. So this bowl out or potential playoff between Archer, Wood and Wokes, I hope one of Archer and Wood is fit, because I think England are going to need that extra bit of pace, and they can't rely on Stokes providing it.
Well, the other thing as well, they might like them both fit for the Wanderers, because if you're a fast bowler, any self-respecting fast bowler is going to want to bowl at the Wanderers. That is a nice, fast, bouncy pitch, sort of like Perth of old. Stuart Broad actually bowled South Africa out there last time. He won the game on the Saturday, and the game ended very quickly. I mean, PE, it's such a contrast, actually, if past history is anything to go by, in those two services. You're right, slow and low at Port Elizabeth and fast and bouncy at the Wanderers. Reverse swing, does that come into it?
At PE.
So possibly Mark Wood. But then Wood, I mean, he hasn't played for such a long time. He hasn't played since the World Cup final. He's been out there. I mean, they picked him to go on this tour. They're sort of hoping that they were going to get him fit towards the back end of the series. He has been bowling, quickly in the nets. But do you throw him in? Can you throw him into a test match? Or do you just gamble on him in that last test match and goes all out pace in that last game? Or do you say, actually, no, Mark, we actually probably need to test you in a proper match before we bring you back?
Well, I don't think that Wood's pace in the Wanderers is necessarily as important, because the ball carries nicely anyway, and you don't need to be rapid, you just need to bowl well. Yeah. At the Wanderers, whereas at PE you need something to take wickets, and South Africa have got that now with Nokia to back up Rabada and Philander. So England need to find that extra ingredient. I think this, obviously, Jimmy Anderson now out has gone back, so it's going to be Broad and Stokes and one of Archer and Wood, I reckon.
You think so, wouldn't you? I mean, they'll want Archer, surely, won't they? He's been bowling. He's missed if he's fit anyway. I mean, if the arm's ready, you'd think that they want Archer. I mean, they Root clearly likes him. He's used him a lot.
It's interesting, the whole elbow thing. I mean, this happened to me actually. It was a football injury as well. Typically, it was pre-season, and I'd already taken probably 140 championship wickets at a low average, and I was bowling high 80s, 85, 86 sort of speed. And pre-season, we played five-a-side football in a gym, and one of the second 11 players piled into me with a sort of ridiculous tackle. I went over the top, landed on my right hand, and the rest of my body went over the top, and my hand sort of stayed where it was. So I used to have hyper-extendable elbows, which gave me the ability to bowl that bit more whippily and get that ball down a little bit quicker. And the elbow went in the wrong way, too far, and all the ligaments got really damaged. And I was out for 2 months. And I was never quite able to straighten my elbow ever again. So it actually, I think, took probably 2 or 3 miles an hour away in terms of pace. And Archer has that hyperextension as well, which is part of the reason why he's able to bowl as quick as he is with so little effort. It's that extra snap of the elbow, that little bit of whip, of extension, that just enables you to bowl that ball that bit quicker, and it comes onto the bat faster than the batsman expects.
Well, they'll be desperate for Archer to be...
So I hope he's all right that reason.
Yeah, they'll be desperate for him to be back to full fitness. I mean, he's their jewel, isn't he? He's their treasure that they want to sort of nurture over the next few years, because without him, England's bowling in the future, to me, looks a bit thin. With him, they've got that real weapon, that pace, that quality that can help them sort of drag them up, really, I think. I mean, it's fairly clear. Whether he's ready for Archer, actually, he's bowled at the Bay Oval, which has been slow and low. He's bowled at Hamilton, which was slow and low. Okay, there was something.
He did have Centurion,
but then there's PE, that's slow and low as well. He'd be thinking,
welcome to the world of Test cricket.
Welcome to Test cricket. He'd be desperate to play at the Wanderers, wouldn't he? He'll be licking his lips. They all will be. I'm all self-respecting bowlers want to bowl at the Wanderers, but I think you make a good point. Actually, it is not just about raw pace at the Wanderers. You need accuracy as well, because you could go around the park there as well. Because I think, batsmen are probably looking to score as well, because
and actually it's a fast scoring ground. And I know we've had a couple of emails from people saying we overplay the effect of the altitude, but the ball definitely goes further off the bat as well as off the pitch. I mean, more sixes are hit at the Wanderers than at other grounds. So, therefore, it comes to the batsman's aid a bit as well, that thin air.
Absolutely. I mean, I saw one day international at the Wanderers where Owen Morgan, he's a reasonably big hitter, but he's not the biggest, is he? You wouldn't necessarily say he was the biggest hitter in world cricket. But if he times it goes, obviously, I saw him hit, I think, one of the biggest sixes I've ever seen at the Wanderers. Hit it out of the ground, over deep square leg, out of the ground, out towards the scoreboard. It was a dark night as well, and the ball, you see the ball going, and it just went into the night sky. Absolutely massive.
And if you play golf at the Wanderers Golf Club, you know, you need one less club for a lot of those holes as well, if you're any good, which I'm not. But, I mean, I remember sort of hitting a 9-iron and it went a lot further. I probably topped it, but it went a lot further than I expected. So it has the same effect. And actually, it has the same effect for bowlers as well. The ball just seems to carry through that bit more. So anybody who sends an email in saying we make too much of the altitude, shut up, we don't.
No, it does fly there. What else in the world of cricket? Well, we've been watching and commenting on a lot of Big Bash cricket. You saw Marcus Stoinis produce a sensational innings. I thought one of the interesting stats you came up with after that innings was that Stoinis faced more balls in a T20 innings than anyone else in history. Is that right?
That is. Well, I think it might have been equal number.
Equal
but it's
number.
79 balls, which is the most that a batsman's ever faced in a T20 match. And I think that says two things in a way. It says, obviously, well played for staying in for the whole innings, but also, does it say he eats up a lot of balls that he could have given to somebody else? Because his strike rate wasn't 200. You know, he got 147 off 79 balls. So what's that strike rate? It's about 170 or something like that. Obviously very good, but it contained 100 in boundaries. Mm. So his hitting was superb. But he's actually well known as a batsman who is powerful, but not particularly good at rotating the strike. Sometimes takes a single off the last ball, as our friend Jeffrey always loved to do, but generally not very good at rotating the strike. And that can be counterproductive in a team. So there was a debate going on in Australia about, wow, fantastic innings, record Big Bash individual score, 147, comfortably more than anyone else has ever made in a Big Bash, on the biggest ground in Australia as well.
The MCG.
The MCG, and hitting 100 in boundaries. But is he better than Warner or Finch opening the batting? And I'd say the answer is no, because both of those, as well as the big hitting, can play a smaller, shorter game too. Yeah. And they're fast between the wickets.
Yeah, he batted for 13.1 overs of the 20 overs. It's unusual that someone bats from start to finish anyway. But when you said 79 balls, I thought surely someone must have played more than that. But actually, if you think about it, it's a lot of the innings, isn't it? It's 79 of the 120 balls. It's a lot.
It's two-thirds.
Yeah.
It's 80 balls would be two-thirds of the innings.
What have I seen in the Big Bash? I saw a remarkable catch from Tom Banton. Well, it was a straightforward catch from Tom Banton, but he did have the good sense to get close to Matt Renshaw, who was on the boundary. Ball was drilled out to Renshaw on the rope. He knocked it up. Well, he went to catch it, and the ball slipped out of his grasp, went over the rope. He stepped over the rope and then leapt in the air as he made contact with the ball. A bit like a volleyball player, sort of batting it back over the net, knocked it to Banton, who'd come to meet him, and they checked it. The third umpire said not out to start with. They had another look at it. His feet were just off the ground. The MCC, who were the guardian of the law, said, yeah, it was absolutely fine as well. And the wicket was Matthew Wade. It was on his way. Caught Banton. Poor old Renshaw gets no credit at all. It's just, you know, in the scorebook, yeah, it says caught Banton. But again, amazing athleticism and quick thinking, really, of you know, boundary fielders. Fantastic to see. It should be rewarded.
Sounds like that game. Have you ever played that game in the swimming pool with your kids? I have with mine, where they insist on taking a tennis ball to any swimming session. And we play this game where you have to keep the ball in the air, but when you touch it, you've got to be off the ground.
Right. Yeah.
So you have to keep your feet off the ground, sort of treading water, whenever you either catch the ball or pass it off. So there's a lot of sort of pushing the ball to each other while treading water underneath. And I'm always the one who drops it or misses it.
That sounds like actually fantastic training for boundary fielding in white ball cricket,
exactly,
isn't it? Yeah. The game I like to play, if we just bring self-indulgent for a moment, is get a tennis racket, get a tennis ball, go to the park
and play tennis.
No. Oh. Play catch, but hit the ball
high
as you possibly can.
Yeah, that's good fun.
Yeah, and see how many they come up with. And while shouting, "My money's on the ball," while they're underneath it, just to put extra pressure
on them. It's good doing that when it's a bit windy, or if it's bright sunny day, clear blue sky, and a yellow ball, because you know the kind of the perspective makes it very difficult to catch.
Tom Banton, he's finished his spell in Big Bash, 3 half-centuries.
I saw the one he made, 56 off 16 balls. Well, he got the 50 off 16 balls. Something special. I like him more than Liam Livingstone, who's just basically a wild slogger. Whereas Banton, I mean, you know, he still plays very, very adventurous, aggressive shots, but I think he has a bit more sense somehow. And I like him. Big levers, long levers, hits the ball miles, yeah, and very consistently.
Yeah, and as time goes on as well, he'll probably just become a little bit more judicious. Sometimes he plays, feels to me anyway, as an oldster watching T20, sometimes he goes for it when he doesn't need to. He can just, you know, bide his time a little bit. I mean, they say, oh, they all, you know, want to go for it right from the start these days. He played one incredible shot in the Big Bash in his last game, where he sort of scoop over the keeper's head. It still catches my breath, that. It's just astonishing shot. It went for 6, way, way over the sight screen. Just incredible skill to set yourself and play that shot, sort of flip over the keeper's head off a quick bowler. Fantastic. So, yeah, Banton, he's one of those players. He's 21. You think, oh, I'm going to look forward to watching him play for the next 10 years or so. Let's hope he doesn't, you know, fizzle out and he keeps it going, because he's a tremendously exciting player to watch if you really enjoy short form cricket.
I've been enjoying Glenn Maxwell as well, actually. I, there's something about him that he's good, as good as AB de Villiers, actually. Not necessarily in Test cricket, but in T20, he's absolutely phenomenal. Fantastic to watch. And actually equally interesting when he's on the mic as well, chatting away to the commentators in between balls, particularly in the field, explaining decisions, having a bit of banter, but really insightful as well, and clever in his little tactics and things. Real, real thinker on the game. Can't stop watching cricket, amazingly. Yeah. He's a bit like us. You know, he's watching cricket all the time.
It's fascinating to listen to players on the microphone. I mean, it obviously works better with some than others. I mean, they use Aaron Finch a lot. He's normally mic'd up. When you see him sort of directing the troops and getting a bit grumpy sometimes, at the same time, as, you know, all this is going out to all the viewers, you do get, I think, a real insight. I'm a bit sceptical about player mics, because I think it sort of takes away from the value of the game, because if a player is distracted the whole time, you can't really concentrate on the game. And if you can't concentrate on the game, you think, well, why are they playing? Is it just a bit of a circus? But actually, if you hear someone do it really well, and I think Finch does it really well, it does give you a real insight, and he talks you through the field changes. And actually, you know, you get a real feel for being out there and what it's also like to be a captain as well, because of that feeling of, you know, sometimes he does, you know, no, come on in, come, what are you doing out there? Come on, come on, you know, you get that real sense of being right in the heart of the action. There are other times when, you know, they go out to players who've just run a three and they, you know, they can barely catch their breath and it doesn't work as well. But if you get it right, I mean, you know, it's an interesting thing for the 100. How are they going to do
well,
that?
They have to do that more because it's good insight into the game and it just gets you closer to the action as well.
If it's done well, though, I think. You've got to have the right people.
Well, players need to understand what they need to tell. I mean, they almost need to spend some time with some media people saying, what do we want to know from you? And making sure they get the right information over.
Yeah. And, of course, if you have the mics up the whole time, you get a Joss Butler incident, as you had in the last Test match, which he's apologised for. Roy says he's going to apologise to Vernon Philander. That's the heat of the battle. That sort of thing has gone on the whole time in cricket. But... yeah, I think what will happen is players, because they will grow up in this environment, they will get so used to it, it will become second nature, which will seem really strange. Because you can't imagine it happening in lots of other sports. Imagine golf, you know, just interviewing Tiger Woods. Tiger Woods is about to play his shot to his third shot to the 18th. Yeah. Exactly what, you can't imagine that, can you? Football, you know, interviewing a goalkeeper just as he's about to face up to a penalty or a penalty... taker about.
I mean, Maxwell was doing this the last game. He was saying, he was on the mic as he was bowling and he said things like, well, I'm going to bowl a cross seamer now. I'll bowl a cross seamer, try and hit him on the pads, things like that.
Yeah.
I mean, that was really good. I think for some...
don't want the batsman to hear, though,
Well, obviously not, but well, you might do, and then you bowl something different.
Well, that's true.
You know, you can easily con the batsman, but I think that obviously Test cricket, you don't want that to distinguish it, but in T20 or the 100... I think you want lots of that because it's engaging and interesting and it adds to the entertainment value.
Yeah. I mean, you say that. In Australia, over this winter, they're using the player cam to come and interview the players at drinks breaks. I mean, Marnus Labuschagne, the last test match between Australia and New Zealand, goodness me, batting for a long time again, he must have been interviewed about five times during his innings, end of day's play, walking off at tea or
but you
lunch
see, now, I mean, people grow up with now, you know, my daughter spends most of her day talking to her phone, either speaking to friends or recording videos to send to people or something. People are much more comfortable now, aren't they, talking to a form of media, explaining what their thoughts are. It's almost second nature.
Yeah, well, it's gonna have to be the way things are going. I mean, cricket, you know, we talk about cricket, some people say it's, you know, it's an old-fashioned sort of game. Cricket has led in lots and lots of innovations. I mean, football's talking about, you know, loads of controversy over VAR. You know, replays in cricket, TV replays in cricket to decide the outcomes have been going on for years now, decades actually. So, you know, cricket not so old fashioned as people think. Okay, Oswald, let's finish off.
Well, just one thing I will say as a final thing. Thank you for all your emails about the 4-day, 5-day test debate. One sort of final bit of statistics from Andrew Sampson on that. One is that in 2019. 35 of the 39 test matches played in the world finished in a result. Mm. So only 4 draws, which is the lowest percentage, 10%.
Sadly, I saw one of those. In fact, I saw two of them.
So that's the lowest percentage of draws since 1932 in a year.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, in this debate, everyone said, well, how do we know how 4-day tests are going to be played? Well, we know what 4-day cricket is because it's played all around the world in first-class cricket. And he's done some stats on 10 years of first-class cricket around the world with something like 4,500 matches and 37% end in a draw. So that suggests that tests, if they were to be 4 days, and I'm not recommending they should be, by the way, except in certain situations, but if they were 4 days... you'd get about a third of them would end in a draw.
Yeah. Well, I think the debate's going to continue, isn't it? And it might well be that the ICC bring in 4-day test matches, whether it's going to be in 3 years' time or 3-4 years' time or in 10 or 20 years' time. It might well be the future of the game. I still prefer 5-day test cricket because I think the best team will definitely come out on top over 5 days, whereas over 4 days, perhaps an inferior team could escape. But... we'll see what happens on that one. Just immediately, England and South Africa?
2-2.
You think 2-2, do you?
Yeah.
So who's going to win this one then?
Probably South Africa.
Okay. And then England to win at the Wanderers?
Yeah.
Might be the other way around for me. We'll see. Fascinating series. As I said at the start of this series, it's always interesting when England go to South Africa. The cricket is always full of fascination. Not easy to predict, actually. But we'll see what happens in the next few days, and we'll review the test match once it's finished.
Thanks for listening.
Goodbye for now.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.